Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker Football Podcast. We are sponsored by BetBall, an exclusive betting community where you can bet together and win together. So if that is your bag and you are over 18, then please download the app, sign up and remember to gamble responsibly. My name is Sam Long and I'm sitting on the other side of the table today because I'm your stand-in host as Jake Entwistle has had the audacity to book some holiday.
And Tom was ruining up his rate, so he couldn't afford it.
Exactly. But the show must go on, and you've already heard from the two guests. So first up is Squawker's chief writer, Mohammed Butt. How are you, Mo?
Me? I'm pretty
yes,
good.
Yes, you.
Yes, me. No, I'm always good. You know how it is, man. Love the podcast.
We also have Will Hall, Squawker editor. How are you, mate?
I'm all right. I'm good.
Good stuff. So
How are you doing in your hosting role?
I'm familiar, but hopefully a seamless transition. We've got a lot to get through this week, despite the fact that European football is in the middle of a hiatus and the international break is upon us. But we're not going to get too bogged down in the international break quagmire to start with. We're going to kick things off with the Premier League as we discuss which Big Six team is in the biggest crisis. Spurs haven't won a Premier League away game since January, and Mauricio Pochettino's role is being questioned. Manchester City have already fallen 8 points off the pace, and Manchester United are being shown up by the super Longstaff brothers. So let's start with you, Mo. Which club do you think is in the deepest pit of despair?
Well, let me put it this way. Who are the worst United in the Premier League? I can't really put it better than that, because Sheffield United just came up and played with more tactical coherence, bravery and organisation than Man United. They were very lucky against Liverpool, played really well. West Ham United, have some issues. They were still West Ham after all, but they play with a bit more organisation, more coherence, and they beat Man United. And Newcastle, you would have thought if it was any United that Man United are better than, it's Newcastle. But no, they got outplayed by Newcastle and lost to Matty Longstaff. What amazing goal. So no, Man United are just absolutely terrible right now, and it's a weird sort of crisis, right? Because let me just give you some stats, right? They have conceded 8 goals, which is joint third. Only Liverpool and Sheffield United have conceded less, right? Sorry, Liverpool conceded less, Sheffield United and Leicester have conceded less as well. They've faced 78 shots, right, which is fifth in the league. Okay, that's only one more than Liverpool. They've faced 30 shots on target, which again is joint fifth, right? So defensively, actually, they're pretty good. You know, they organise, set themselves up well. But here's where it gets really funny, people. Man United create 83 chances, right? Which you're thinking, seventh, that's not too bad for a team in crisis. 9 of them are big. 9 big chances created in the Premier League so far. That's 17th. That's relegation form. In terms of getting, so creating a chance created for anyone who doesn't know is basically a pass that ends in a shot, right? Big chances are what was classified as big chances is a very clear and obvious goal scoring opportunity. So United created 83 chances. So they're taking some shots, but in terms of good quality chances, good looks at goal, 9. Oof. And they've taken 79 shots and they've had 33 on target, which means, by the way, they've faced almost only one less shot than they've taken in the Premier League this season. And they've hit the target 33 times. They've had their target hit 30 times. Those differentials, 1 and 3, are way too small. And it's not that their defence is bad. Again, they're defending their top 6, top 5 level. Their attacking is just awful.
So what you're saying is they shouldn't have sold Lukaku.
I mean, ultimately, obviously the facts bear out the fact, yeah, you shouldn't have sold Lukaku, but ultimately I don't even think Lukaku would have necessarily solved their problem, because their problem isn't so much that they're not taking chances, although they're not, it's that they're not even really creating good ones either. Remember, 9 big chances created. Their problem is that their midfield is a joke. It's Paul Pogba. And I mean, look, everyone's praising Scott McTominay right now, but Scott McTominay, he's playing well, but he looks so good because everyone else is so bad. Even Pogba is sleepwalking through games right now. If you told me that Solskjaer said to Pogba, give me one more year, you can go next year, I'd believe you. Because 100%, Paul Pogba right now looks like he's just sleepwalking through games, waiting to get to the end of the season, and that he can leave. It looks like Cristiano did in 2008-09. You know, 11 years ago, when he was like, he gave Ferguson one more year, and then for the first two-thirds of the year, he was just like barely there.
I'd say that Man United feel like, it almost feels like Man United as a whole are sleepwalking through those games, because the Newcastle game, within about 2 minutes, you could just tell this is going to be an awful game of football.
They're all awful games of football, mate. Honestly, every Man United game, apart from the Chelsea one, has been, and maybe Wolves, has basically just been atrocious. Because, I mean, I suppose really you can look at it as the fact that as soon as Martial got injured, everything, because then Rashford has to go up front, and then you've got no wing depth. Like, that means Andres Pereira is playing constantly because he has to, because there's no one else to play on the wings. So, you know, they're so precariously balanced. I said at the start of the season, look, United can challenge for top four if Martial and Rashford stay fit and they're banging the goals. Martial hasn't stayed fit. Rashford predictably has struggled to consistently score goals without Martial there as well.
Well, on that, so...
Yeah.
If at the start of the season their aim was top four,
yeah,
they're now 12th with 9 points, the same as Sheffield United and Brighton.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is their aim for the rest of the season now? Is top four already gone?
I don't necessarily think so. It depends. I mean, look, they need to get to January very quickly. If they can stay within like touching distance of the top four, it's not impossible, because as I was about to say, as weird as it is that they are terrible right now. They are a mid-table club, firmly, not even upper mid-table, firmly mid-table. But if they can add a striker and a winger or number 10, a goal creator, like I said, a goal scorer and a goal creator, they become not just a top six side. They become like a genuine, they'll contend with, they'll contend to be the third best team in the country, basically. It's a really weird situation they're in, because Solskjaer's organised their defence. As I said, those numbers are really good. And considering, by the way, they're not creating any chances, so their defence is constantly facing pressure. The fact that they've got the fifth most or fifth least shots faced in the Premier League is very impressive. Like Wan-Bissaka and Harry Maguire have been amazing. Lindelof was a bit ropey early on, but he's shaped up really nicely as well. Twanzebe has come in and looked brilliant. De Gea, he's been okay as well. He's been good. So their defence is really good, and all they need, and it sounds ridiculous because obviously they're so bad in attack, but if they add a goal scorer, they add a goal creator, it's going to lift them up hugely. And then they can challenge the top four. But the thing is, if they don't buy those players early, and it can't be at the end of January, it has to be early in January, or if they just fall too far off the pace between now and then, which is possible, by the way, because again, if you watch them...
Yeah, I was going to say, January is so far away.
Yeah, you just can't see...
if you're pinning your hope on a January signing.
No, but then Martial might... When Martial, if he can get back soon, that's going to be huge, because he is the kind of guy, he can play with back to goal, which Rashford can't. He can score those nasty little tap-ins, which Rashford can't. And that's really what they need, is they need someone who can like score the odd chance here or there. And then that changes everything, because so often United, they can create half chances, you know what I mean? Or, I mean, look, they made a huge mistake not signing a number 10. I know they tried to sign Dybala and Eriksen and they were rejected and everything, but you can see they're crying out for a number 10. Juan Mata belongs to a completely different style of football. Jesse Lingard is not, he's a specialist. He's a defensive specialist. He's not an attacking player, creative player. Dan James is playing really well, but he's very young and you can't rely on him for consistency across the entire season. So, and Pereira is just, he's not a Premier League player. I mean, maybe bottom half Premier League player, maybe like relegation, like, you know. But even then, honestly, no. Like, I wouldn't, like, you'd say, oh yeah, he's a Sheffield United player. I don't think he'd get in Sheffield United's team, if I'm honest.
Oof, scathing.
Pereira. He just looks like he's up to, with the exception of set pieces, I don't see what he does on the pitch. And Solskjaer has to keep playing him, because he literally has no other option, except for maybe throwing Chong or Greenwood into the Wolves. And those guys are teenagers, and if you play them consistently in this environment, that could be very detrimental to them.
Yeah, I understand that, but I think Solskjaer kind of has to stick to his guns now, because having sold Lukaku and said, oh, I'm confident that we've got the young players who are going to be able to come in and play, you kind of need to play them. You can't be now sort of saying, perhaps protect them.
Well, he's playing Greenwood in the Europa League. I think what he doesn't want to do is burn the kid out, because remember, he's just turned 18, so it's like he's very young, and he is, and this is the other thing we should really mention, which no one really wants to talk about, the kind of dirty little secret. United's youngsters, for the most part, aren't that good. They're not that good. You look at Chelsea's and Arsenal's, and they're playing a lot of kids, and they're all the ones they're playing are by and large very good. Very, very good. They've got what it takes to make it at the Premier League level, with the exception of Greenwood and Twanzebe, who are both. Twanzebe's amazing, and Greenwood looks very promising. I don't know if they're all that great. You know, McTominay is an average player, which if you surround him with better players, he could be really good. But Chong, you know, Angel Gomez, I don't know that these guys. I mean, look, they're probably better than like Pereira and Mata right now at this point. But I'm not sure they're the answer. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, and it's this Man United, it's all waiting for Solskjaer to be like, we're trusting the kids. But if the kids aren't good enough, there's no point trusting them. Do you know what I mean? And this is why I was saying United need a number 10 in the summer to organise their attack. United need a striker. And look, I mean, Thomas Müller now apparently wants to leave Bayern Munich. I mean, if I'm Ed Woodward, I'm jumping all over that. You know, honestly.
So you're signing Rakitic, Zlatan.
Well, Zlatan's not going to happen. That's just my dream. But no, honestly, Müller and Rakitic, very experienced, proven winners, and instantly what United need, I think. Both of them. Rakitic would add leadership and direction to that midfield. He'd be a really good player in the back. You can play him defensively, you can play him attackingly, whatever you want to do. Attackingly? My goodness. Or you can play, and then Müller, I think, is just everything United need. He scores goals, interlinks with forwards, creates as much as he scores. He's not a selfish player. Won't just stand up there and hog all the chances. Will help create chances. Very good. Proven veteran, proven winner. Would be adored by the Man United crowd. A bit niggly, a bit nasty, which United fans love. So, I mean, you know, and they're both 30, pushing 30, 31 sort of age. So they're both perfect veteran age to come in and be the leaders for these young Man United players. And I think if I'm United, I would just move for them, secure the signings now so they can come in 1st of January and be in straight away. Yeah. Because United need players, they need bodies. Because, like I said, crisis. It's bad now. It could get so much worse. It could get better, but it could be really bad. This could be Moisey. This could be seriously Moisey.
Well, in terms of the odds, they've drifted out to 4-1, and then it's actually Leicester who are next ahead of them on 11-4, and then it's Spurs on 5-4 to make the top four. And I wanted to touch on them because they are pretty much on the verge of a full blown crisis. And Will, we watched the Brighton game together, and we both said that it was concerning to see Pochettino on the sidelines, not even looking angry, just disappointed in what he was seeing. It's like the old cliche of when your parents you do something wrong and your parents they're not mad, they're just disappointed. And I've been defending Spurs for a couple of weeks in that I think that they're going to be all right because their entire team has been out of form, which seems sort of strange to say, but I was sort of banking on as soon as maybe one or two of them get back at it, then their entire team's form will improve. Yeah. But
it is a funny claim to make that an entire team is out of form. that would suggest that the manager is doing something wrong, or there's something a bit deeper. The problem goes a bit deeper than like individual performances, though.
I mean, their defence is it's going to pot really. So Alderweireld and Rose are looking like two of the most unsettled. Lloris is obviously now out long term. Aurier can't be relied upon.
No, just as he was sort of being praised as well.
He undoes the hard work. Yeah. So I wanted to touch on just the goals that Spurs have conceded, because really, one of the hallmarks of what he's done is made them they've never really conceded too many goals. So last season they conceded 39, which was the joint third best in the league. In 17-18 they conceded 36 goals, which was the third best in the league. In 16-17 it was 26, which was the best in the league. That was the peak of their powers. And then 15-16 35 goals, which was joint second best in the league. But this year they've already conceded 12 in just 8 games, and you do really need to worry about the defence, because so many of the team is unsettled in there. And I think what's new for Spurs as well is that since Pochettino has taken over, it's been praise. They became the media darlings as such, and they've been praised for punching above their weight, and rightly so. But now I almost feel like they've moved up that bracket now. Almost like when a boxer goes from middleweight to super middleweight, because once you're in that new fight, you're judged by those standards, and it's a bit wishy-washy to say, oh, well, I'm up against the bigger man, I'm up against the bigger clubs, because if you've reached that point that you wanted to get to, then you need to be judged by that. And Spurs are effectively going through what Chelsea, Arsenal, all the other clubs who are in that bracket have been going through for decades now, really, which is if you lose a few games, then you are in crisis. So some of the excuses are definitely wearing a bit thin. So they've got Watford up next, this is winless, bottom of the table, lowest scorers in the league, Watford. Yeah. If they don't beat Watford, then you would have to say are...
It's like you would naturally think it's the best game they could hope for, but the fact that there's no excuse if you lose against Watford, that it almost applies more pressure.
I think for me the big thing about Spurs is stagnation. I think what we're seeing is not so much that Pochettino has become a bad manager or that their players have become bad players. It's that everything's the same. The Poch has been there now, 6 years? Obviously, the Bella Gutmann's famous thing is you have third year is fatal. He's had 2 third years. And this is his second third year. So, and obviously, it's not always 3 years, but you look at the great teams and they tend to work in cycles. So either after 3 or 4 years, either the manager leaves or the players all change. So you look at the great Sir Alex Ferguson, all of his teams usually lasted about 3 or 4 years, and then he had a big shake-up. So the treble side, great treble team, amazing. Then they won two more league titles after that, and then that was their third/fourth year, 97-98 was their formative year, that treble team. And then they broke up. They lost the title to Arsenal, and he made changes and changed again. Arsene Wenger's perfect for this. Comes in, has a side built largely around Bruce Rioch and George Graham's people. Wins the title, then has a hybrid. That's 3-4 years. Then he has a hybrid team, 3-4 years. Then he has the Invincibles, which is his side, 3-4 years. Leads up to Paris. They're losing Paris to Barcelona. And then after that, he's just been mishmashing. He's been terrible because that was his moment. And then you look at Jurgen Klopp at Dortmund, the same sort of thing. Emerged in 10-11, amazing team. 11-12 retains hold, even better. Smashed Bayern in the German Cup final, 5-3. Amazing. 12-13, still a bit struggling in the league. Get pegged back by Bayern in the league. Make the Champions League final and you're thinking, here we go. And then they lose the Champions League final. Right? Pochettino, and then up after that, Klopp's Dortmund were a season after that, and then they collapsed. Literally, they were awful 2 seasons after making the Champions League final. And no one could figure it. And Klopp is a great manager because he's since gone on to Liverpool and won the Champions League and been very good. So you look at this, and then
this is Pochettino's opportunity to go through that as well, isn't it? Because at the moment we're talking about it negatively, but if he does turn it around and navigates this difficult period and guides Spurs to, say, a third place finish, and then clears out the squad in the summer and they come again, then he'll be being praised for having rejuvenated.
But if I could offer an opinion, I think this is it.
No.
I think he's done. Because if you look at, I mentioned Wenger and I mentioned Klopp, right? They made the Champions League final after a long period of being at the club and then didn't win, and then it very, very quickly went to pot afterwards. Poch, been at Spurs 6 years. His team is basically the same as it was after his first season. So if you look at it, all like 8 players from the starting 11 of the first day of the Premier League season are still at the club. Like, literally, Walker's left, but that's because Walker got a big for his boots. Moussa Dembele left because he got old. And that's honestly a bit from the starters. And he's brought in like a couple of other players. I know in the summer they spent big with Ndombele and Gianni Lo Celso, but they needed numbers, not just quality players. They need a lot of changes.
But then that was always going to be his strategy, though, because he likes to bring young players through, and he has done that.
Yeah, but it's the same thing. He hasn't rotated enough. Like, I mean, you look at Alderweireld and Vertonghen. It's not that they're bad defenders. They've been at the club for so long. And like, when you've been there that long, and it's not just those two, it's the entire team. There's literally no position where there isn't someone who's been there for ages. He hasn't refreshed his fullbacks at all. Like, and it's so bad.
Well,
and
I say fullbacks the position in which he's
where he's done
most,
well, no, because Rose and Davis are still there. The right back has been changed, but only because Walker got too big for his boots and left.
But that's the thing, though. He did try and sell Danny Rose in the summer.
Yeah, but he tried to sell him for three years. But he didn't, though, isn't it? That's the thing. He didn't sell him, and that's why the squad all looks the same, and they all look so stagnant. They've just stopped listening to him. Not I don't think even purposefully. Yeah. I think they've just gotten very comfortable with themselves.
I think Pochettino can only take a bit of the flack for the sort of contract situations and stuff, because I feel like Spurs are almost paying the price for...
Yeah, Daniel Levy is the way he does business, obviously, with 2005 wages, you know, not really splashing out the transfer market and everything. That has hurt them, and the stadium has hurt them as well. And famously, I suppose, to be fair, to Arsene Wenger, I mentioned that earlier, 2006 was when the stadium came in for Arsenal as well. So maybe this moving stadium thing isn't all it cracked up to be in the short term, because it really hampers your ability to compete. But yeah, you look at Wenger and Klopp, they made the Champions League final, lost. Pochettino made the Champions League final, lost after 6 years at Spurs. It was such a big moment for him because remember the celebrations after they beat Ajax? Do you remember the tears? And it was so, you could tell how much it meant to him. He finally, after all the years of nagging him to, he finally prioritised the cup. He had put the league aside because their league form went to hell after the Champions League came back in spring. And he said, okay, fine, you want a cup run, here's a cup run.
I think he was always consistent in his view that the Champions League and the Premier League were the only competitions he thought he could...
Yeah, but he always
win and then have it be sort of a worthy achievement.
But he always gave them I agree, but he always gave them equal footing. Like he literally was like, forget the Premier League, let's just win the Champions League, and they came so close. And I think had they won, I think almost he might have even walked away, or maybe it would have transformed it and he would have been able to buy whole new players and everything. But I think it's the end of the road, and I think you saw that because Liverpool won the Champions League, but they're still. This side has been, the Liverpool side has been existing since what, 2019, basically the start of it? Or sorry, the start of 2018 when Coutinho left. So like, and Van Dijk came in. And it's like, so, I mean, obviously Klopp's been there a long time, but like this current side in this shape, in this sort of structure.
It's difficult to say because it's been so gradual, but I guess that's how you should build teams.
You know, yeah, no, it is. And he's done it very well. But I think even Liverpool, you look at like, he's probably got 1-2 years before think he has to make a big change or something. So yeah, I don't know if Spurs, I think it's a death spiral for them, man.
Yeah, well, bringing up the Spurs Stadium, I think what's been really noticeable over the last week or so is the almost radio silence that's come through at a time when the club would have wanted to be shouting from the rooftops, and that's with the NFL rolling into town. It's only going to they're only going to play their first game at the stadium once, and Spurs must feel like that they've missed the opportunity to sort of capitalise on that. I'm sure if they've been playing a bit better that they would have had players doing promo or getting involved with the NFL a bit more. We know that Harry Kane has sort of openly said that maybe that's a future career move. But I think that I probably would have seen more about the NFL on social media when the games were being played at Wembley than this most recent one at Spurs. And perhaps behind the scenes that could be disrupting things a bit more. Perhaps there's some sponsors, some pressure from the NFL. So it's definitely a difficult situation for Spurs. But I would argue that they're not in as big a crisis as someone like Man United, because Man United are in...
I would agree. Yeah. It's a weird situation where I would say, yes, Spurs aren't in as big a crisis, but I also, unlike Man United, I think Spurs' crisis is terminal. It sounds weird to say because United are horrible right now. But Spurs are much better, but I do think Spurs will probably even out a bit more. I don't think they'll even out enough to get top four, but they'll even out more. Whereas United, you could see United jumping up hugely if they get new players. Mm. Whereas I don't see Spurs getting themselves out of this crisis unless they get rid of Poch.
It's worth noting they're only 3 points away from the top four as things stand. Yeah. You could conceivably see them going joint fifth if all the results go their way.
Yeah.
When the international break concludes.
So moving on from Spurs, we have conveniently forgot about Manchester City, who are the defending champions, but seem to be going through. Is it a blip? Is it a crisis? Will, what do you think?
There's a reason it's not a crisis, because despite them, so attention grabbing is Liverpool's 8-point lead at the top of the Premier League that it's easy to overlook the fact City are only 2 points ahead of Crystal Palace in sixth. A team. I think they play them in their next game, and you know what happened last time. They rocked up at Selhurst Park. They would appear to be furthest away from their objective. And I think if you suggested that City would get dragged down into a battle for top four this season,
the indignity
that would
of
be
it.
The most outlandish prediction you could maybe make. Not that I think that is the case currently, because obviously there's once more games get played, then the table will break up, and I think you'll see Liverpool and Man City out there on their own. So the reason it's not a crisis is because they're definitely the most equipped to overcome the lead that Liverpool have established. So Liverpool are 4-6 with Betball to win the Premier League. Man City aren't too far away from them on 5-4, which more or less reflects where my head is at in terms of how this title race actually looks right now. It's I think the 8-point lead is misleading, especially given that they play each other twice. But there is a particular now or never element to the cost of failure for Man City this season, in the their stated aim is not as simple as just saying, I'll win the Premier League, because becoming champions again would also mean they equal the daddy of all records as far as top flight domination in English football history goes, which is, I think I've heard Mo refer to this as the three-peat before. The kids are calling it the three-peat.
I'm not a kid, but I'm calling it the three-peat.
You're more meme savvy than me. Only two teams have done that since the Second World War, Liverpool and Manchester United. I think Huddersfield and Arsenal are the other teams that have won three consecutive English top flight titles.
It's not something that happens very often.
Exactly. Mm. So that's the evidence I provide for the claim that that's a very rare thing to do. So the challenge of even putting yourself in the position to do this is immense. It's more likely that they won't find themselves in this position again before Pep Guardiola leaves. So it feels, like I said, a bit of a now or never moment. That said, I think there's this, of all the teams we've mentioned here, they have the smallest gap between their best case scenario and their worst case scenario. I think their worst case scenario is still second, because none of the teams around them look like they have the quality to shunt them down. Arsenal being there, like, everyone's seen all the memes that were just spread across social media, the clown one memes where it's like
with the soldiers,
like, with the soldiers coming in, there's just a clown dressed behind them, referring of course to Arsenal. And I think that pretty much sums up
it's like you say with City, it's the old Ricky Bobby thing: if you ain't first, you're last, you know. So it's that, that's where City are right now,
definitely. I think objectively, in terms of points, which is the objective measure of teams in a league competition format, they're the furthest away from their objective. But
their defense,
but they're also kind of not.
Well, their defense. Look, this is the worry for City, I think, is that again, we've looked at the three teams I mentioned: Man United, Spurs, and City. And the thing with Spurs is obviously, okay, they have good players and whatever. But and Man United, you can see how signings would help them. With City, it's like, What are they even do? I mean, it's kind of the same boat as Man United. It's like, what do they even do until January? Because they have no defenders. And Otamendi is their best defender, and he's awful. It's like, what do they do?
I don't know if I'd say he's awful, but
he's not the kind of guy you trust in. I mean, if it was, let's say, Laporte or Vinny Kompany or Virgil van Dijk, or, you know, you'd say, okay, yeah, they could lead a ramshackle defence through. I mean, they concede goals, but yeah. Sure. But, you know, Otamendi's like, you know, he's like Dejan Lovren. He's like, yeah, I'm great. No,
Dejan Lovren also isn't awful.
No. But that's what I mean. It's like he's a good defender.
I get the comparison.
He's a good defender, but it's like, you wouldn't want him. And if you put him with a great defender, you're like, yeah, okay, cool. You can just, you'll be the hatchet man. You'll be the big header guy. Mm-hmm. But when you're playing with, when he's the main defender, that's a problem. And I mean, Fernandinho, if anyone watched City versus Everton, or City versus anyone, but Fernandinho is not a centre-back.
Another instance in which the sort of bet ball odds support what I've just said is they're 1 to 100 to finish outside the top four. So I think a pound bet gets you a penny, excluding the
nailed
stake.
On then.
Now, you know, I mean, for me, I think the solution is Walker at centre back for City.
Guardiola said he'd never do that.
Yeah, I know, but it's like it's so strange that he said that, because first of all, he'd be better than Fernandinho just on pure athleticism alone. He can run back and cover, which Fernandinho can't. And secondly, he's not like the thing with Fernandinho and Otamendi. There, both of them want to come to the ball. So, like, there's no one coming behind to cover, as Walker would come behind and cover, not to anything, go to the ball. And secondly, they have João Cancelo to replace Walker at right back, who is really, really good. So, I mean, to me, that's the obvious move. But if he says he's not going to do it, then he's not going to do it. Although, let's not forget, this is the guy who once played Alexander Kolarov at centre-back. So,
yeah.
I don't know why he's suddenly averse to Walker playing there. But
it's because Southgate did it first.
Yeah, probably. He's like, no, it's mine. I don't want to copy him. But it's, it's weird to call City in crisis. But like Will says, I think, you know...
I know.
When you're aiming for a three-peat, anything other than a title win is a crisis. Because it's like...
I think Man United, Spurs, definitely you call that a crisis. What Man City are going through, you wouldn't. But
it's a contextual crisis.
It was I think it was good to bring them in here just because.
No, I think contextually,
it's the biggest story in the league.
I think contextually for them it is a crisis because, like you said, to get the position for a three-peat, you have to win it back to back, and that on its own is rare enough.
One team who I think are what you would consider a crisis, Everton. Obviously, they're not one of the traditional big six, but they are 18th in the league, and they're 33-1 for the top four. With BetBull and 14-1 to get relegated.
I mean, they were in the best of the rest.
Yes, they were. My prediction for the team that could mount the toughest challenge.
It's all just sort of
just because I wanted to go against the grain and not say Leicester.
It's all just sort of. It's weird how it's all like. They signed well in the summer. Like, Moise Kean is very clever.
I was speaking to one of our writers, Chris Smith, who says that their biggest mistake was not signing a centre-back.
Mm. Well, I mean, I would argue that their biggest mistake was selling Idrissa Gueye, because it turns out, when you have a tackle machine in midfield, it kind of covers up for a lot of problems.
They did try and keep hold of him in January, and Coutinho-esque sales where it was like, yeah,
PSG want the kid, you're not going to be like, no, you can't go. But it's, at the same time, it's like, maybe, you know, they had to. I mean, it sounds absurd to say, but like, when a player puts out that kind of absurd defensive output, when, I remember Idrissa Gueye puts up Kante numbers without the PR of Kante. Well, without the team, he unfortunately never plays on the same kind of teams as N'Golo Kante, and he's not as lovely. I mean, that's not a fresh one. Idrissa Gueye. No, that's not. I'm sure Idrissa Gueye's a nice guy, but N'Golo Kante is just one of the loveliest people ever. But Idrissa Gueye puts up Kante numbers. He's that level of a defensive machine. And the cover and protection that offered the Everton defence, not something necessarily you even noticed, but clearly we're seeing the improvement. And yes, they didn't replace Kurt Zouma at centre-back.
Yeah.
And Michael Keane and Yerry Mina is not really a good partnership, whereas Kurt Zouma could have played with Yerry Mina or Michael Keane. Whereas I don't think Michael Keane and Yerry Mina is very... I don't think either of them is like...
He's your boy, isn't he, Yerry Mina?
I love Yerry Mina, but first of all, Yerry Mina is the best centre-back in the world. Right, that's the first thing. Second thing is, though, I don't think he's like the kind of guy to be like, all right, lads, this is what we're doing. Whereas I think Kurt Zouma has that sort of... Remember, Kurt Zouma won the Premier League title in 2015 with John Terry when he was, what, 19, 20? And Mourinho played him every game, which says everything about him. You know, Mourinho doesn't play teenagers unless they're amazing. So Zouma's an incredible defender and an organiser. And I think Everton miss him. And they miss Idrissa Gueye. And I think
they have conceded the most goals from set pieces this season in the Premier League with 5, which was a big weakness they looked to have addressed towards the end of the previous campaign. And that's like that's over a third of the total number of goals they've conceded this season, which I think is 13.
Short goalie, isn't it?
That might be an issue, but I think it's the lack of a centre back. More than the lack of an Idrissa Gueye.
I mean, yeah,
because they've actually conceded the fewest. Third fewest shots on goal in the league this season so far, behind Man City. And
so it would be Zouma more than Idrissa Gueye, then, I guess.
Yeah, potentially. I don't think they'll get relegated. For whatever that's worth. I think their crisis is kind of an unending one, in that they're not good, don't appear to be good enough for the top four, despite how much money they invest. But too good for relegation.
Well, I think
again referring to something that Chris said, he referred to it as major European League syndrome, which is the situation in which a sort of mid-table club that wants to, with ambition, that wants to go for those top spots is just continuously hit a ceiling.
You need
above which all the super clubs just sort of, you know.
You need a good coach. That's the difference. Like, look at Leicester. They got themselves Brendan Rodgers, and look at them. They're penetrating that big six now. And I think even if Man United hadn't been a hysterical disaster, I still think Leicester would have gotten in there and done their business, because I think they've got a very good coach. And I don't think, is Marco Silva a very good coach? Is he the guy? Everton have spent a lot of money, and I think they've spent a lot of it quite well. I mean, obviously they didn't sign a centre back or anything, but. You know, you look at Brendan Rodgers, this is a different kind of example, but you look at Chelsea, when they had, when they got Jose Mourinho, suddenly they went from, oh, these guys got a lot of money and they made a fluky Champions League run, to, oh, these guys are serious business. So it's all about having the right manager. Maybe Everton should get Jose Mourinho, you know? It's all about...
Yeah, well, he supposedly just turned down Leon for an English club, so maybe he's biding his time.
Yeah, maybe he is. But no, that's just it. Oh, mate, wouldn't he love that as well? Winning the same city as Klopp, Merseyside derbies would be unreal. Everton need a better manager than Marco Silva, I think, is the clear sign. if they want to penetrate the top six. And I do think, I mean, if they keep playing like this, he'll get sacked and they'll replace him with someone. Probably not Mourinho. Although maybe Mourinho, I don't know. I mean,
definitely not Mourinho. So that wraps up that section. We're going to take a little break before we take a look at Germany's game with Argentina and England's trip to the Czech Republic and Bulgaria. The biggest game we've seen during the international break so far is Germany against Argentina, which was of course a repeat of the 2014 World Cup final. It's fair to say both teams are in a state of flux and transition. This was actually the first time since winning the final 5 years ago that Germany had not selected any of the players who featured on that famous night in Rio. Germany racing to a two-goal lead through Gnabry and Havertz, but Argentina fought back with two subs on the scoreline. A superb header from Alario and then a late deflected effort from Ocampos. So Mo, first up, what did you make of the game and what do you think of Gnabry's form?
I mean, the game was alright. It was nice end to end. It's kind of what you want a friendly to be, you know, a nice attacking game. No one's really trying to, or not doing too well defending. Marcus Rojo does something. I mean, if you've not seen this, look at Germany's second goal. Marcus Rojo is on the touchline, pinned back by a German. And he nutmegs him. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful nutmeg. But then the process of nutmegging him, he gives the ball away. He nutmegs the guy. And then Klosterman runs behind his teammate and nicks the ball away. Legs it down the other end of the pitch. Passes it to Gnabry. Gnabry crosses it. And then Havertz scores. So it's just like...
Classic. Rojo.
Yeah, I mean, does something amazing. And then also manages to give a goal away somehow. It was a good game. It was a fun game. I think Gnabry is unreal. I mean, like I said, they got the assist for the second goal. Scored the first goal with, I mean, an outrageous... first touch. You watch it. The cross comes in from the right, from Klosterman, who had a very good game, the right wing back, which you can sort of see why they're confident enough to move Kimmich to midfield, because they have a real option there. The cross comes in and he's like got about three defenders around him, Gnabry, and he could easily just try and whack it first time, but he just jumps up a little bit and takes this really sort of delicate and very deliberate touch. On the first angle you watch, you think, oh, that's a fluke, right? But then you watch the replay, you see that no, he's raised his foot and very deliberately touched the ball gently over the oncoming defenders, and then as the ball comes in, he just toe pokes it in. Very good goal. That's his 10th in his last 11 games for Germany. It's 6-6 in 2019. Belarus away is the only game he hasn't scored in for Germany. And it's 8-12 for club and country this season. So he's absolutely, like, obviously smashed four past Tottenham at Wembley. No, sorry, not Wembley, Tottenham Stadium. And he's playing out this world right now. And it's, he's looking like, you know, obviously Bayern sold Ribery and Robin in the summer. And obviously Robin, of those two, was a big goal scorer, big goal threat. And he looks like he has everything in him to be the new Robin, in the sense that he'll score the goals, cut in off the flank. Obviously, he's on the left, cuts in onto his right rather than cutting onto his left. But you can see, and you saw in at against Spurs, it was like a mirror image of Arjen Robin. You know, the speed off the flank, cutting in, merciless finishing on his foot that he's cutting on. So, but
he's been playing a bit more central, I think, hasn't he, for Germany as well?
Yeah, I mean, they play 3-4-2-1, so he plays in a bit more of a central, kind of occupying the half space, but he's still essentially a forward there to score goals, and he does that very well. What's interesting is that he's only scored one goal in the Bundesliga, one goal in six games. So, and Bayern on top. So,
it's because Lewandowski's been. Well,
it's the interesting thing about it's the sort of thing you wonder about him is that, is he a great goal scorer? Is he going to be like 20 goals a season, or is he the kind of guy who's going to show up in the big moments? Because that's what he's done so far. Obviously, amazing in the Champions League against Spurs, big match. And for Germany, he's just constantly there scoring goals. And international football obviously is just a succession of big games, because it's like, oh, now you're playing. There's like 2 months off or whatever. So. You wonder where he's going to fall, and we'll have to see as the season pans out. But again, 6-1, 1-6 Bundesliga games makes me think maybe he's not necessarily going to be like a relentless hammering 20 goals a season kind of guy. Maybe he's going to get like 15, 16, but they're all going to be massive. And that maybe, you know, everyone's talking about Coutinho being the guy to get by another line of Champions League. Maybe it'll be Gnabry that will be the one that actually fire them over the line of the Champions League in the big games. Most recently against Liverpool, you know, they just found themselves wanting. So you know, maybe he's going to be the guy for Bayern. And Germany, obviously, definitely, he looks like he's in one of the most dangerous weapons at the Euros next year, because he just seems to be able to sniff out goal-scoring chances. He scores them neat, little, scruffy little tap-ins and very nice goals like we score against Argentina. So I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know if he's going to have like an amazing season for Bayern. He might do. We'll see. In terms of consistency, but in terms of big moments, I would look for him to really have a big impact for both club and country.
Personally, I don't think he's got enough credit for his celebration.
It's a pretty great
celebration. Do you know the explanation? I saw you post this in the group. Are you willing to reveal it?
Yeah, NBA, I can't remember the guy's name now. Though.
James Harden.
That's it.
There we go.
So it's the chef.
Teamwork.
The chef, yeah.
He's cooking it up.
Because sometimes Alaba comes in and does the pepper as well. It's a good celebration, man.
It's a very good celebration. It's cooking it up, cooking things up. The NBA's got a lot of good celebrations, to be fair. Because you've got to think on your feet, because you can't stand and celebrate like in football. So you have to run back to your own basket. So you have to do, it's always with your hands. You have to be very creative.
But then I've always thought, though, this is someone who doesn't watch a lot of basketball. If you have a trademark celebration, you're a basketball player, surely you're pulling it out 20, 30 times a game. Because they're scoring points after points after points.
No, but you don't.
Save it for a particular point?
You save it for big points. You don't do it because first of all, again in basketball, because it's end to end, you score. You have to get back and defend. You can't be standing like that. So you do it for like daggers, buzzer beaters, big points that make everyone go crazy, and your opponent takes a timeout, and then you walk off going like, yeah, do the celebration. Everyone's cheering for you. So you don't do it for every point, because then you'd just be, I mean, Harden scores 40, 50 points sometimes, you know, he'd be doing it constantly.
But Gnabry's scoring so many goals himself that...
he's going to have to think of a second one now, isn't he? Because he's got the one, it's like you need a backup, you can't be doing the same thing every time, you know. Got to mix it up.
So going back to Argentina, Scaloni's got a fair amount of flack since he took charge. But how much credit do we think he deserves for his substitutions? Ocampos in particular looked really good when he came on at half time.
I mean, he's been really good for Sevilla so far this season, and he's the kind of player, like, he was one of a really, really bright prospect, and then he went to Monaco when Monaco weren't good and just sort of fell off. Like, he's this really, he's huge, he's a big guy, he's like 6'2", he's that really big, muscular player, really good dribbler, really quick with the ball at his feet, very creative with dribbling and moving past players. But, you know, he has questionable end products sometimes. But, you know, he came on and he added a lot of thrust to Argentina yesterday. And Ilario obviously got a goal and got an assist. I mean, his...
Great header it was.
The header was really nice. I mean, obviously Germany declined to mark him, which kind of helped. And the second goal was because he ran through the whole midfield. Like, he ran through the German midfield. Like, there was no one there. Like, Kimmich... Defensive midfielder is like, Josh, you have to actually defend people.
I think the defending for that goal, it was the classic sort of when you've been 2-0 up and then it goes 2-1 and you're half thinking the game's won.
It's like, you take him. Wait, no one took him. Oh, God, he's walked through our entire team. Yeah. You know, it's... But yeah, I think, look, it's interesting because you look at a lot of the players. They've got Lautaro Martinez up front. Obviously, he's got a hat-trick recently for Argentina. Very, very talented. And you're thinking, you know, I mean, look, Argentina are still nowhere near as good as their reputation is. But if you look at Ilario, you look at Ocampos, you look at Lautaro, you put Messi in the middle of those kids and not like other people who are from the same generation as Messi, so who are also now in their 30s, approaching their 30s, and who are also scarred by years of failure. I think it could be quite interesting. They could be interesting to watch. You know, there's still plenty of flaws. How solid is the defense really? I mean, if Rojo is still playing a fullback, what's going on there? But, you know, there's always promising things to take. And you know, with Messi...
I think if you've got Messi... Anything, I mean, you could put Messi in a midfield four with us three, and I think we'd score some goals.
I mean, I don't know about that. He'd score some goals, and we'd maybe go, yeah, goal! Or maybe we'd get assists like Busquets.
I could get on board with the policy of pass it to Messi if I was in that situation.
I mean, you know, it works. It's how Luis Suarez stayed in the Barcelona team for all this time. So, you know, it's not a bad prospect to have. No, look, it's. I think Argentina are interesting. I think they're quite clearly trying to develop an identity or a way of playing that isn't constantly just give it to Messi and pray. Just so that then if they do introduce Messi back in, which I expect they will do once the tournaments roll around, so the Copa America, the World Cup, I think there's no point bringing him in for qualifying unless you're really desperate. So I think, you know, if you have a functional way of playing that you can then plug him into, it's like, oh, and then he just makes you much better. As everyone sort of seen with Barcelona, where they were very functional without him, and then he comes in and suddenly they're really good. And it's like, oh, what a surprise.
Okay, so let's move on to England next, who face Czech Republic on Friday and then Bulgaria on Monday as they look to maintain their perfect start to European qualifying with 4 wins from 4. And the game on Monday is going to be played in front of a partially closed stand in Sofia. So in a pretty sad reflection, really, where we're at in society, racism has been high on the agenda in the build-up to the games. Players facing questions about potentially staging a walk-off and how the team should address the issue going forwards. And Will, I know that you wanted to bring up UEFA's three-step protocol. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So the three-step protocol was established in 2017 for the Confederations Cup, as best I can tell. It was described as a watershed moment by the FA chairman, Greg Clark, in that it is essentially, in quotes, he says, firm action. It is essentially something that provides a formalised route to abandoning a match in response to racism within stadiums. So to quickly run through what the three steps actually are. Step one, it says, should the ref become aware of a serious racist abuse, and that's a direct quote, a stadium announcement is issued telling those responsible to desist and the game is paused. Step two kicks in if the behaviour persists beyond the restart, and if it does persist, teams are sent to the dressing rooms as the first official suspends the game for, and I'm quoting this directly again, a reasonable period of time. A further announcement is then made. Mm-hmm. And in step three, if racist conduct does not end after the game is resumed, the match is abandoned indefinitely. And although Clark described it as a watershed moment, he was quite critical of one element in particular in terms of how it needs to evolve, and that being specifically in terms of the wording. You'll notice during that I sort of heavily signposted when I was directly quoting it, because the first one, serious racist behaviour. Now, the problem is that it fails to reflect the sort of standard, you would hope, universal rule that any racism is serious.
Yeah. And also, I suppose it doesn't stipulate on numbers as well, does it? If it's a single chant or if it's a group chant.
So this is it. And also, the ref in step two, I directly quoted them, a reasonable period of time. The problem with this is that the language is quite vague and it leaves room for ambiguity.
Mm.
It creates ambiguity specifically for referees. Not that I'm defending those involved. In fact, maybe the opposite, you might think. Because you can find several examples of instances in which FIFA or UEFA have announced investigations into why their protocol wasn't followed. One of which was the chance, abusive chance directed at Kalidou Koulibaly last December. And perhaps the wording in its ambiguity is creating sort of room for referees to not act, essentially, because they have to make the call on whether, I mean, what constitutes serious racist behaviour.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen in Serie A that a lot of response, not every response, obviously, there's been a lot of issues, a lot of people in Italy fighting the fight that this racism is wrong, we have to stop it. But there does appear to be a large group of people in Italy who just seem to think, yeah, it's not serious abuse, we're just trying to unsettle the players.
Mm. Well, the ultras responded. Well,
if referees share that belief, which they may do, we don't know. I'm sure some of them don't.
So to be clear, I'm not saying that the referees don't also subscribe to the view that all forms of racism are bad, but I'm just saying that it's almost a pointless a couple of words in there that you could just cut as any example of racist.
Yeah, they've given them the loophole, haven't they, really?
That's what I'm trying to avoid saying, really. I'm not suggesting this is a loophole they're taking because they want to continue the game. I'm just saying it puts pressure on them because it puts the ball in their court. They have to make a decision. Mm. If they just objectively... if they were operating under the clear instruction that any racist abuse.
Yeah, I think that's the issue, because abandoning a game or even pausing a game as it constitutes taking the teams back, that costs money because games are broadcast. You know, so it's like, and so I would agree with you, really, in the sense that you're making saying, go on, referee, you decide if this game is worth broadcasting. So that way, if it does happen, and if a broadcaster says, oh, you've cost us X amount of money from the way you delivered the old council game, and they can say, oh, well, the referee made the call. So it's like you put it all on the referee, which isn't fair, really, because...
But then if anyone's... It's fairer for the referee to make the call rather than the players.
No, the referee should make the call, but I just think that, like Will says, the law puts it all on the referee, whereas the referee should have said, look, there was racial abuse, the law says they have to stop the game. Whereas now, because the law, like Will says, puts this little word in here with their serious racial abuse, then the referee puts it in for a reasonable amount of time. Then basically you're saying the referee's made the call about is it racial abuse, is it a serious amount of time, and then ultimately is the game abandoned. So it's like, you know, it puts too much on the referee, whereas the referee should have the power to make the decision, but it should be because literally the law says unequivocally, look, if there's racist abuse, stop. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
To bring this back to the England game, I think the reason this is in the news is because Gareth Southgate has said, where he's previously said that he will leave it in the hands of the players to choose how they want to react should any of them become aware of racist abuse. He's clarified his comments more recently, saying that we've developed a better understanding of what UEFA's three-step protocol is. And Fikeo Tomori, in his media responsibility this week, said that they've been briefed on what it is. I think Trent Alexander-Arnold also said the same. They've been briefed, and the plan is to respect it on the pitch. Tammy Abraham is another person who's spoken, though, and he said that the players have discussed it amongst themselves. Harry Kane said that if anyone feels like they're being targeted, then they might take the decision to collectively all come off the pitch. Mm. That's why you're seeing headlines like England players prepared to walk off in the face of racist abuse, because they've suggested that they might skip to step two if step one isn't enacted by the referee. And Southgate himself in that interview acknowledged that he has seen examples of games recently where the referee has been following. So I think it's something that's being it appears he's of the belief that it's something being more rigorously applied.
I mean, I would,
in previous games,
just as a pure opinion, I would argue opinion wise that step one is pointless. I don't think it would have any effect, because you've seen instances of like where referees have stopped the game and tried to get them to stop, and no one's going to stop. It's like being told by a teacher, please stop yelling in class, and like it almost becomes a mob mentality. Whether or not whatever the abuse is, they're not going to stop. You have to literally completely stop the game, get the players off the pitch. I think it should be a two-step process. First step is take the players off the pitch. Okay, you've got like 10 minutes to stop, or we're going to cancel the game. Oh, you haven't stopped? Okay, game's over. You know, I don't think there needs to be any sort of... and then obviously the visiting side wins. The side who's been racist abused wins like 3-0, whatever it is. I don't think there needs to be any sort of like, oh, go on, please stop being racist. We need to be very harsh with these people. And there needs to be dot points involved. If you're found guilty of racial abuse, there needs to be zero tolerance for it. And that is very harsh. You know, and people have said before, I've said this on Twitter and that there should be dot points to stadium as well. That's really harsh. Like, yeah, it is harsh. It has to be harsh because...
It's on UEFA, isn't it, to do that? No, because they're handing out pretty pathetic fines.
Yeah, and I mean, that's always been the case. I mean, the England U21 incident in Serbia back in 2011, which a lot of the current England setup players played in. Raheem Sterling, Jordan Henderson were there. You know, so it's they've been there. I think Danny Rose was there as well. Yeah, he was. He got sent off, didn't he? And because he got so fed up of racial abuse, hearing racial abuse all night, he lashed out, kicked the ball into the crowd, and they sent him off for that. And it's just, you know, and it's so, racism is so dehumanizing that you know, to put it to this whole rigmarole. Will nailed it there with this, putting it all on the referee. To, oh, go on, referee, you make the decision now. I mean, look, these FIFA and UEFA need to be, no, we'll make the decision. Racism is wrong. Well, if it happens, the game is over. And it's to soften the language and make it vague enough that we can then blame it all on the referee if it goes wrong. Because that ultimately, it does seem to be that's what they want, is they want plausible deniability if sponsors and TV broadcasters come up and say, hey, why are you cancelling games, mate? What's going on here? Because that, it does cost, football is big business, and cancelling games, delaying games costs a lot of money. And will cost people a lot of money. Advertisers will not be happy. If you have scheduled an advert for halftime of a Champions League game and the game gets called off 20 minutes in because of racist abuse, you're not going to be happy. No one's going to watch your advert. You know, so then you're going to be like, excuse me, UEFA, what's going on here? You know, if you're Amstel or Gazprom and you've paid for like 4 adverts, you know, so it's... And then they don't get seen. So it's just, you know... Money is the big thing, I think, is that people are just afraid of calling games off. You know, to put it all on one referee, who's already got enough to deal with, by the way, you know, refereeing a football match at the highest level is not easy. Then to also be like, oh, should I cancel this game? Oh, but the sponsors won't like that. And if it all comes down on you, rather than you can't just say, look, the law says this. Because sponsors are like, oh, no, but look, it says reasonable there, mate. What, you know, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very difficult issue. And I don't think we can do it justice, really, in a sort of 10-minute segment. But if we move back to what is actually going to take place on the pitch, and fingers crossed we don't have any incidents of racism or anything over the next couple of games. The player I want to discuss is Tammy Abraham. It's been a big year for him. Obviously, he was on loan at Aston Villa last season, but now finds himself joint top of the Premier League goal scoring charts and in the England squad. It looks like he's going to get his competitive cap, which will obviously lock down his allegiance. So are we fans of his work? Do we think he deserves his place in the squad?
Definitely deserves it. Big fan of his work. What more is there to say?
That's the end of that chapter.
No, it is, though. That is the end of that chapter, because he's great. And, you know, I'm so impressed and I'm so happy for him, because obviously, you know, he's been at Chelsea since he was, 8 years old? He's been there forever. He loves Chelsea through and through. You know, didn't look like he was going to get his chance. Was so bad at Swansea. But then Swansea were bad. So you're wondering, is he bad or Swansea bad? And, you know, is he a Premier League striker? Oh, I don't know. Very good in the Championship. 2 years running for Bristol and then for Villa, which is no mean feat, by the way. And so you're thinking, oh, okay, is he just one of those that's just like really, really good in the Championship and not quite good enough, like Dwight Gale almost. Very, very good in the Championship, not quite good enough for Premier League. And you're thinking, that's not a bad place to be, but I mean, wouldn't it be nice if he can actually do the business? And I think this is where Chelsea's transfer ban has just been wonderful. Because I think if it wasn't there, they would have signed someone and we would never have found out. We would never have found out if Tammy is good enough. They couldn't sign someone. Tammy took the number 9. And look, he's a Premier League striker, guys.
Yeah.
Eight and eight.
As Lampard's sort of been keen to stress as well, he hasn't sort of gone in unopposed. He has made the shirt his own ahead of Giroud and Batshuayi.
Yeah. You've had French manager Didier Deschamps sort of not begging but requesting that Frank Lampard play Olivier Giroud in response to Lampard's request for him to not play N'Golo Kanté.
Poor old Giroud.
Yeah, no, he just seems to forever be in this position. Especially overcoming the early season psychological setback.
He took the number 9 shirt, which is cursed. Missed two chances at Old Trafford. You're thinking, uh-oh.
Missed the penalty.
Yeah. And then in the UF Super Cup, you know, and then so you're thinking, oh, Tammy, no. But hey, you know, I had one game out against, I can't remember who it was now, because Giroud started. Came back in against Norwich, two goals, three goals. You're thinking, oh, okay. But then he stopped and he went 3 goals without a game. And you're thinking, oh, 3 games without a goal. God, I keep doing that. He went 3 games without a goal and you're thinking, oh, Was it just a purple patch? But then he came back. His goal against Lille, by the way, is really nice. His goal, he's actually very good and he's found his rhythm and he looks like he's going to be a consistent goal scorer for Chelsea. And he's why Chelsea are where they are, by the way.
Hmm. Like, we may have mentioned this on the pod before, but just in case we haven't, one of the findings when we did that script and he ended up as Chelsea's top goal scorer is that if he is their top goal scorer in the Premier League, he'll be for Chelsea. He'll be the first Englishman to do so since Frank Lampard himself, which would be
the narrative.
There's some poetry, and he'll be the first number 9 to probably do it since Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, I would imagine. So because their number 9 since Jimmy have been, well, Crespo had one decent season, I guess, but otherwise it's been kind of ropey. And that's the thing. It's so gratifying to see young English players take on big challenges and then actually prove themselves worthy of them. Mason Mount's another one doing very well at Chelsea. Fakayo Tomori has suddenly like come out. I mean, not out of nowhere. He was at Derby last season, but like almost Premier League level. Like, whoa, wait, hang on a minute. Is he their best defender? Obviously he's not. He's very young still, but he looks phenomenal. He looks really, really solid. And you can imagine him and Rudiger as a partnership when they get a chance to set that up and develop it over time. That could be very good.
On England, though, is Abraham going to play at all, though? I mean, we're pretty well stocked in attack, especially if we're going to play front three. Surely it's just going to be Kane.
He'll come off the bench, I think, in one of the games. I think he might start because Southgate's shown a tendency to rotate in the breaks. And I think, you know, if the situation favours a bit of rotation, he might do it. You know, I mean, it's not like, and if you're going to play Tammy Abraham from the start, now is the time to do it when he's in good form and he could bag a goal on his England debut, competitive England debut anyway. So, I mean, I'd play him against the Czech Republic. I'd play, keep Kane for Bulgaria because that's away and that could be very difficult. But I'd play Tammy against Czech Republic, 100%.
I mean, he's definitely going to give him a cap.
Just because he
wants to look him down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know,
I think South. Well, for his part, Southgate has said that it is immoral to cap players just so that national teams such as Nigeria can't call them up.
I think he'll definitely play against the Czech Republic. I would start him because you're not going to learn anything from Harry Kane playing against the Czech Republic. I believe
England can secure qualification in the Czech Republic game with a win. So that means the Bulgaria game, there's not really anything to play for. So you might see some debuts in that one.
James Maddison will be cursing his luck.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you could definitely... I mean, if that's true, actually, what Will says, if they're secure qualification, you could definitely see Fikayo Tomori and Tammy Abraham maybe getting their battles in Bulgaria. Jadon Sancho will probably start that game. It'll probably be Kane, Rashford, Sterling against Czechs, and then Sterling and then Sancho will come in for one, and then maybe Tammy come in for another one against Bulgaria. I don't know. We'll see. I think Chelsea have suddenly got these three very, very talented young players who can come into the England squad and be direct contributors already. I mean, Tomori has the downside that he plays in Maguire's position, so he's probably not going to start. But, you know, Mount, England doesn't have a good midfield. Mount could play. There's no reason why he couldn't. He's better than Barkley.
He's had his first competitive cap already, hasn't he?
I'm just saying, it's like, I mean, you look at, they can actually, I think Abraham is the backup number nine England have needed for a long time, because Kane is a three-dimensional player, right? And the other backups, Rashford and Vardy, are one-dimensional and they can't really play with the ball. They can only play in transition as a number nine, but Tammy can play with the ball and without the ball, and I think also the fact that he scores goals consistently is a huge thing for a backup forward, to just be able to come in and bang goals in. So I think, and you can put them together as well, because Kane is a number 10, a bit of a number 10 really. So he gives England a lot of options.
I would say the advantage the Chelsea players have over Maddison, who is obviously withdrawn through illness, is that I've heard it said by many reporters that one of the big factors Southgate and England coaches take into consideration when playing players is whether they've played at the highest level. And the exposure to Champions League football, players like Tammy Abraham have had, might make it more likely that they come into the 11, whether as a starter or a substitute, more quickly than Maddison, who has actually played far more Premier League minutes, I'm fairly confident in saying, because of that exposure.
Yeah. Plus, it's also that Maddison doesn't really fit into Southgate's system as much. That's true, 4-3-3, you know, Maddison is a number 10, more of a number 10, which is kind of a problem for him, because obviously Southgate doesn't play a strict number 10. He could definitely play, but
he's obviously been used on the wings before as well. That's probably more competitive.
England have three wingers, like they're Rashford, Sterling and Sancho are the three guys. The fourth one will probably be Hudson-Odoi. Once he gets fit, I think he'll be the fourth. I think that's it. You're not, unless one of them gets injured, you're not getting in on the wings for England. I think those four are the four. In midfield, you know, there's chances in that. I do think Mason Mount will lock down a spot. I genuinely think that, because I think he's more reliable than Barkley. And I think, you know, honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if, as long as the injury hasn't affected him too much, if Loftus-Cheek does as well, and if the England midfield three at the Euros is Declan Rice, Ruben Loftus-Cheek and Mason Mount, I think that'd be a good midfield three as well, to be fair.
I thought you were a big Harry Winks fan.
I do, but Harry Winks is I think it's clear Southgate prefers Declan Rice, so I think Winks will be the sub, and I'll be tweeting, bring Winks on, and then it won't happen, and I'll just be frustrated.
Okay, so that's everything on England. We're going to take another break, and then we'll be back with a Squawker 6. So, as has become tradition, we're finishing off with something a bit more light-hearted with a new Squawker 6. We're going to be picking the best players of the Premier League season so far. One player for every position, but only one player per club. So, let's start with goalkeepers. Obviously, it's been a bit of a difficult one this season. Alisson's been out of the picture. So, Will, who are you going for?
Lucas Fabianski.
Mo?
Bernd Leno.
I've also gone for Bernd Leno. Why have you picked Bernd Leno?
Because he's faced 136 shots, which is the second most in the Premier League. He's had faced 45 on target, which is the most in the Premier League. But he's also made 34 saves, which is the most in the Premier League. And he's got a save percentage of 75.56, which is the third most in the Premier League. Basically, Arsenal's defence is rubbish. He's being constantly worked. And he's actually playing pretty well as a result. Arsenal conceded a bunch of goals. They would have conceded even more if he hadn't been in goal. Don't get me wrong, the temptation to pick Alisson was there because he has 100% save percentage, but he's also played like what 40 something minutes and faced two shots. But so I thought, no, let's not go too into that. So no, yeah, I think Leno's played very well. I think he's steadily improved since he's come into the first picture as Arsenal's first team goalie, been getting better and better and better. I remember I didn't put him on the top 10 Premier League goalies last year around like just start the end spring and everyone asked him, I was like, what are you doing? I was like, calm down, he hasn't been that great yet. But since then he's really sort of almost proved me wrong. He's gotten better and better, and I think this year, given he's had no help from his defence, he's really playing quite well.
Yeah, I've put him in purely on the progress point as well, because I've never really been a big fan of him, but he's definitely making strides this season where some others who would be more reliable stuttered a bit.
Yeah, I've picked him because I've got an Arsenal player coming up later. And Manuel Pellegrini, I think, said he's the best goalkeeper in the Premier League recently.
I mean, Fabianski.
So that's good enough for me.
I mean, Fabianski, what is it? His performance versus XG shots on target or something like that is phenomenal.
So he always figures quite highly in terms of stats. Yeah. I think, like you said, you guys have obviously picked Leno because he's made the most saves. But I'm going with Pellegrini's word.
And also, I didn't want
to. I've not got a goalkeeper now for 2 months because he's obviously injured.
So. So next up is fullbacks. Who have we gone for?
Ricardo Pereira.
Aaron Wan-Bissaka.
I've gone for Pereira as well.
Yeah.
Most importantly, he's level on points in fantasy football with Trent on 40, and he costs 1 million less. Jesus. So. As a tip for you.
There you go.
Pereira is one of those really underrated fullbacks, but for me, I've gone for Wan-Bissaka because if you've watched Man United all the season, you'd realise that without Wan-Bissaka, they would have been absolutely cornholed by everyone. He's injured. He played one game less, I think, than Wilfred Ndidi. He's made 5 tackles this. He's got 35 tackles, which is the fourth most in the Premier League, right?
Do you know who's made the most?
Yeah, Wilfred Ndidi. But it's the fact that he missed so many games. When it comes to per 90, Wan-Bissaka has 5.17 tackles made per 90, which is first among all players that have played more than 45 minutes, at least more than 45 minutes. He's a tackle machine. He's had to be a tackle machine because Man United are terrible. And he is, along with Maguire, basically the reason why Man United have had this. I mentioned earlier they've had a solid defence, and it's because Wan-Bissaka has basically shut down the right flank. He's been incredible. He's been, you'd never think 60 million for a defensive fullback, that's not going to be value for money. He's been value for money so far, and I mean, I imagine it will long continue as well. You know, obviously Trent is also phenomenal, second most chances created, second most big chances created and everything, but, you know, I've got to pick another Liverpool player later, so come up with Wan-Bissaka.
It's actually Ricardo Pereira, I believe, who's made the most tackles.
Wow, that's tackles. Not to pull a Jake Ent whistle, but there's probably a difference between tackles and tackles one there that's caused that discrepancy.
Is this going to be a bigger beef than Rebecca Vardy and Colleen Rooney?
Well, I'll tell you what, Will, I'm going to block you, everyone but you from my Twitter, and then we'll...
You're going to block me from the Opta Query Tour.
Okay, so centre-back is next. Who have we picked?
Fikayo Tomori for me.
Ooh. I mean, this is why I didn't pick Trent. Big Verge, the nicest man in man football.
I've also picked Big Verge. Felt like a bit of a cop out because I don't think he's been as good this season.
Well, yours is actually quite controversial because I'm seeing a lot of people suggesting that Joel Matip's been better than Virgil van Dijk this season. So it's
just not true. Come on.
Look, well, as we know last week, though,
I heard about that. He laid into him at Sheffield United, even though he made a couple crucial interventions.
Matip is really good in the air, and I think that people, because he heads
well,
a lot
of also there. He's also just been named Player of the Month, hasn't he? So
it's that Chris Smalling thing where you think, oh, hang on, this guy's really good because you watch him head loads across his away, but then like you watch them defending on the deck and he's nowhere near Van Dijk. Van Dijk, and although yeah, Van Dijk's been shut up in the Champions League, I would argue. Huang Chan made an absolute mug of him at Anfield. Someone's fine dribble past him. In the Premier League, I think he's been solid as ever. He's a great leader, great organiser. Alisson's been missing since the start of the season and no one's really noticed, except when Adrian's passing it to opponents, obviously. No one's really noticed because Van Dijk's been so solid. And I mean, to go from Alisson to Adrian and to not really notice it is pretty huge. And that speaks volumes of how important Van Dijk is. If Van Dijk doesn't get injured this season, Liverpool are going to walk the league. It's that simple. If he gets injured, it's all up for grabs. But if he stays fit, it's over.
Okay. Pretty strong views there on Van Dijk. So next up, we've got centre mids. Who have you gone for, Will?
Kevin De Bruyne.
I've picked John McGinn.
Oh, eh?
Oh, really?
Spicy.
Wow.
Because I'm trying to shuffle De Bruyne into my wing, my winger role.
For reasons that will become clear in a minute.
So basically, we've all picked De Bruyne, you've just put him somewhere else.
Yeah. Most assists in Europe's top five leagues with 8. Most chances created as well. His passing's been, compared to David Beckham's, twice this season. I don't think there's been a player who's been hyped, had their like moment of just absolutely everyone, all the pundits, the Sky Sports studio raving over them. To the same extent as De Bruyne this season.
He's basically Beckham and Scholes in one package, which is absurd when you think about it. Here, watch Beckham and Scholes. He's ridiculous. He's so good. The only weakness he has in his game, and it's not even a weakness, is the fact that he doesn't control games and slow the games down like normal central midfielders do. But because he's so good at speeding them up and scoring and creating goals, it doesn't matter. He's unreal. He's absolutely incredible.
I think he's the clear front runner for the player of the season. What must be said is a very early stage, but yeah.
I mean, if he keeps assisting at the rate he is,
but you obviously think McGinn is.
yeah. Well, how's John McGinn got in there ahead of De Bruyne?
I needed to shuffle De Bruyne out wide to get McGinn in. Three goals in 8 games.
So you're playing De Bruyne out of position to get McGinn.
Yes. That's the difficulty of this, with the parameters of only being able to pick one player per club. And because I wanted to get a new face in there, really, and I've been really, really impressed with McGinn. Villa got him for peanuts, and if he continues the way he's going, they're going to be selling him on for big money in the summer. I mean, also, Man United already sort of started to be linked with him, haven't they?
And their transfer policy is such that it's not difficult to link players with them in terms of speculation. They just have to be young and British and good.
Especially Scottish as well.
Yeah, true.
So we know that my makeshift winger is Kevin De Bruyne. Who have you guys picked for your wingers?
Sadio Mane for me.
Emi Buendia.
Oh,
that's a good one as well.
That is a good shout.
I mean, look, 20 chances created, 2 of them big, 22 dribbles completed, 68.75% completion rate, 6 most dribbles completed. He's joint fourth in terms of chances created. He's really good. He's having a great season. He's taken the Premier League by storm. He's the reason that Timo Pukki's done so well. He's the reason Norwich have done so well. He was immense against Man City when they won. If you're picking multiple players per team, you'd probably have Sterling ahead of him, Mane as well, maybe even Salah. But, you know, with the limit in, I think he comes in just behind those guys, which is amazing when you think about it.
And Will, why did you pick the dive merchant?
that is actually the reason. I'm a big fan of divers. Then. winning a last-minute penalty is still an achievement. Just regardless of your view on whether it was simulation or the correct view that it was absolute stonewall penalty and he could have been seriously hurt.
Diving is an art. Let's just put it that way, right? Deco.
It's a dark art.
It's a dark art, but it is the skill.
I don't know if it's an art. I think it's a sad reality that if you don't do it, then you're putting yourself at a disadvantage.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why it's an art.
But anyway, I think it's more so it's the shit. His goals always tend to be important ones. So there's the equaliser against Newcastle, or there's the opener against Leicester.
That equaliser,
and
by
the opener against Southampton. They always just seem to be the goals that get Liverpool.
The goal against Newcastle, by the way, was utterly ridiculous.
I know,
the way he made it look just so easy, and it's like that's not what he did was not easy. Just I mean, I like Sadio Mane a lot. I just want to point that out because I did pick Mendy ahead of him.
I also, despite Salah having been sort of off his game in the views of many in recent games, it was difficult for me to leave him out. Because I think he has been quite good.
Salah is quite interesting in that a lot of people talk about him, oh, he's not playing well because he's not scoring, but he does a lot more than just score, which is easy to forget because when he scores, he scores so many. But he's been quite good as well. Look, Liverpool have got an amazing front three. It's probably, it is the best front three in the world right now. So, they're pretty great. Although, watch out, PSG, when they get all their three back, that'll be interesting.
So that is wingers. And now all that's left is forwards. Who have we gone for?
Aubameyang.
Nice.
I did pick Aubameyang and then I realised the limit. And I picked Firmino, remember the limit. And so I'm like, oh yeah, well, who's after them? Big Tammy.
Yeah, I got Tammy as well, actually. I don't think he's necessarily better than Aubameyang or has been better than him, but I just wanted to pick someone who's, again, new to the league and announcing themselves.
8 goals in 8 games, 30.77 conversion rate. So it's sustainable. That's a very high conversion rate. It probably will drop a bit, but he's doing the business for Chelsea. And look, let's be very clear. He is the reason Chelsea are where they are. When those games, he scored 2-2 and then 3, they would have lost all those games if it wasn't for him. So he's won them 9 points right there. He's been absolutely incredible for Chelsea. And he's been the reason. Before the season, I was particularly writing Chelsea off like, no one's going to score goals. They're done. Because I thought that Tammy was a championship striker who couldn't make it to the Premier League. And he's proven me wrong. He's proven everyone wrong. He's been phenomenal. And, everyone's talking about how promising, good and lovely Chelsea are. And that the reason of that is because Tammy Abraham is scoring goals. He's winning them games. He's been incredible, I think.
And you're...
Yeah,
you're,
no, it's Jake went into his ability to quote-unquote dunk on teams a couple episodes back, so I won't dwell too much on stuff we've already covered, but I don't think there is a player in the Premier League who's had a bigger influence on the table as it stands. It's demonstrated by all the, like I said, the clown memes that I mentioned about Arsenal's position in the league. They're third in the league, and yet they haven't really convinced us. And the reason they're third in the league is because Aubameyang scored in 6 Premier League games, which is the joint best record. His goals have been vital to the points that they've amassed.
I can remember having a very drunken conversation with a friend of mine at a wedding that became quite heated about why Aubameyang was not world class. And I think I'm probably going to have to eat my words on that one.
Oh, right. You're on the... was it Jake that you were...
Okay, that's a wrap for this episode. Thanks to our sponsors, BetBull. Thanks to our guests for coming on, Will.
Always a pleasure.
And Mo.
Outstanding work from all today.
And thanks to all you lovely listeners out there. We'll catch you next time.